And up next on the stream of free radio at freakradio.org, it's me and you and the show I call Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, the March 28, 2019 edition. 2 hours of fun and frolics, actually a lot of me talking, lots of interviews, examination of the struggle to save the Ross Camp folks in the sense that they are currently out there right behind the Gateway Plaza shopping center area, and they're about to be threatened with a kind of a wholesale deportation to nowhere, masquerading as, of course, compassionate assistance to shelter services, when in fact the shelter services simply don't exist for even for the people out there, much less for the entire homeless community. Something kind of that's been half-assed acknowledged by the, well, it's been acknowledged by some members of the city council, essentially denied by the staff who claims they have the shelter to accommodate folks as of April 17th, and that date has been moved up to really to April 10th in the terms of when the people are going to be, quote, encouraged to move out of the Ross camp. But there's counter stuff happening, too, and then we're going to be talking about that. There's a community meeting coming up at 7 o'clock on April 3rd. I think it's the 3rd. Let's see. 1st, 2nd, 3rd. Yeah, it's Wednesday night of next week at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. When the Ross Camp folks will be meeting the community, and people will be gathering to try to figure out a proper resistance to any kind of premature attempt to destroy people's homes and community with phony claims that there's going to be places for people to go when there aren't. This, of course, is really very typical of how homeless encampments are destroyed in city after city without any adequate alternatives. And I'll be discussing that. And you'll be able to hear it, and you'll be able to comment on it at that meeting. And also, if you've got comments on this show and you want your comments aired on the air, as I mentioned to the community when there was a recent council meeting a couple of days ago, you can give me a call at 831-423-4833. 831-423-4833. That's the number for this particular radio show, which isn't really on the radio and the air right now. We're on the stream, but we're a long-standing broadcast regularly, which has been on the air, which hopes to be on the air again, and which solicits your attention, your involvement, and your action. That's really what I try to do. So stay tuned, and we'll see if that happens.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's jump in and begin with a film called Seattle is Dying, which I haven't seen. I've just seen clips of it. However, I kind of know the narrative. I heard it full and up close at the city council meeting, two city council meetings, one last Tuesday and one the week before that, by people who were apparently very moved and upset and vitalized by the film, which is essentially a description of the homeless situation in Seattle as being essentially a big drug-induced problem caused by the lack of strong policing and the enabling of homeless people through, oh, I don't know, respecting their constitutional rights and through suggesting that you have to treat them like human beings who have the same rights as people in housing, instead of, quote, intervening, putting them in programs, jails, moving them away from residential areas to protect the children, this kind of claim that they're a danger to the community. And really, it seemed to move the group that wanted to stop, and apparently has stopped, although it hasn't been officially ratified yet by the council, the Depot Park dusk to dawn so-called safe sleeping area, which is sort of the city council's band-aid excuse for eliminating the Ross camp, beginning on April 10th and concluding on April 17th if they proceed to do it, which I think is not only immoral and abusive, but preposterous, considering what the results will be, as I said, at the council meeting, people streaming into the community just all over the city because their own community is going to be destroyed and bulldozed because it doesn't aesthetically please the folks who are our city mothers and fathers, actually the city council cowards and the staff who are running this essentially look good for tourists, reassure the neighbors kind of situation, independently of any real fundamental concern or respect for the rights and needs of folks outside. What I'm going to do first is play you a tiny clip of the Seattle is Dying news special, which is, I guess it was originally published by, or presented on the TV by KOMO, which I haven't watched. I'm not from Seattle, so that's probably why I haven't. But it'll give you a taste of what it's about. You can find it online, and you can view it yourself. But then I'm going to read you a critique of it, and we'll kind of take it from there.
Seattle is Dying. It's a harsh title, to be sure. Dark. In the end, I went with it because I believe it to be true. I believe that Seattle is dying, rotting from within. The program isn't about demonizing those who struggle with addiction and homelessness. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Instead, we ask the question, why aren't we doing more? Why don't we have the courage to intervene in lives that are, in the face of a grave sickness, reeling out of control? And we give voice to the people who you haven't heard from. Parents who are afraid to take their children to parks. Police who don't feel they're being allowed to enforce our laws. Citizens who don't feel protected anymore, don't feel like they have a voice. This program is a reminder, in case we've forgotten, that this is not normal. This isn't the way it has to be. This is not right.
And of course, there are video images of people who are homeless. One guy stretched out on the sidewalk, then apparently looks like a junkie, possibly nodding out. Garbage along a stretch of land. And police cars lined up with their red lights and the red and white, blue lights flashing. And then we have, this is actually, this movie I think was made, or at least it's narrated, by a guy called Eric Johnson of KOMO TV. And now it's, well, here's some of the critique. And this is a critique by Charles Mudded. And it was done March 18th, about 10 days ago. And here's what he's got to say. The local iteration of Trump TV, also known as KOMO, recently aired in an hour-long news special attempting to offer an examination of Seattle's homeless crisis that's as sober as possible. To make sure the viewer is sufficiently alarmed, it is called Seattle is Dying. This city, with a GNP or GDP of over $250 billion and a corporate community with a market capital value that's over $2 trillion, is experiencing nothing less than its final days. It has one foot in the grave. The problem? KOMO believes that it's a lack of dick-hard policing. Seattle law enforcers are powerless, or to use the sexually charged wording of a cop who's interviewed in the special, impotent. One shot shows bike cops unable to do a damn thing about Rastafarians sitting on a park bench. liberal city council, and that Jah, and not Jah, is protecting them from Babylon's oppressors. The consequence of this limp dick policing is that the productive members of society can't get a break and take their kids to the parks, and one supposes their dogs as well. The 206 actually has more hounds than snotty noses, and citizens no longer feel safe. The, quote, news, unquote, special gives a voice to these apparently unheard of people. At one point, I guess he means unheard people. At one point, an interviewee, the owner of a bouncy house business, damn near breaks into the opening lines of The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stairs, you know, they just don't care. I can't take the smell, I can't take the noise. Seattle today, according to Trump TV, is just as bad as New York City was back then in the late 1970s, those dark, dark days when the Big Apple was told to drop dead. Now let's get serious. Back in the 1990s, linguist Noam Chomsky described mainstream media as a complex of organizations that manufacture consent. But it also manufactures a specific and clearly irrational set of social feelings. One such feeling is a hatred for the poor. In a world that is not inverted, the opposite would be normal. A publicly spirited media would never fail to manufacture a hatred for the rich and view the endless accumulation of money as, to use the words of the most influential economist of the first half of the 20th century, John Maynard Keynes, a disgusting morbidity, one of those semi-criminal, semi-pathological propensities which one hands over with a shudder to the specialists in mental disease. The thing one should always wonder at, and in this wonder appreciate the enormous power of consensus building, is that this kind of behavior, hungering for more money when you already have too much of it, is not designated as semi-criminal in our world, but its very opposite. The victims of this semi-criminal, or just outright criminal, otherworldly passion for money, are totally normal. And so the concentration of massive amounts of socially produced wealth in the hands of a few and elite, and yes, very white, Seattleites, is not seen for what it is, criminal. But the visibly extreme poverty imposed on thousands of people, yes, many of whom are people of color, is. Not having access to a culturally based standard of living is breaking the law. What does this tell us? That the manufactured hatred of the poor justifies a perverted world that criminalizes the condition of poverty. Please give this a moment of thought. It's not as obvious as it seems. It's downright bizarre. It should astonish you in the same way that the sight of an elephant flying with its ears would. What's truly fantastic is that no one's throwing cuffs on the hands of the maddest members of the city, the Bezoses or the Schultzes, and locking them up in an insane asylum. I guess he's talking about some rich, powerful people in Seattle. In this, our perverted world, what's abnormal is not obscene wealth, but its consequences. In one moment of Seattle is dying, a camera mounted on a drone rises from the human filth on a hill and slowly turns to the towers of tech, municipal, and financial power. In this inverted, perverted KOMO world, the shock is not that the business district is right next to a homeless camp, but that a homeless camp is right next to the business district. There's an important difference between the two perspectives. In the second, the camp of misery is not about the city killing many of its people, but extremely poor people killing an affluent city. Now that is rich. And that's a brief commentary by Charles Tundere Meded, the Stranger's film editor. Apparently this is a website called The Stranger. He's a Zimbabwean-born cultural critic, urbanist, filmmaker, college lecturer, and writer who collaborated with the director Robinson DeVore and so forth and so on. A number of films written for a number of publications. Now, that was a little dense, actually, and here's an article by Catherine Hinrichsen, March 20th, on Crosscut, which is a little more accessible. In just 30 seconds, the promotional video for KOMO-TV special manages to cram in at least 10 invasive, voyeuristic, incendiary images of people in crisis on the streets of Seattle. After the requisite swooping scenes of tents and garbage along the freeway, it ended with the ominous title, Seattle is Dying. Given that introduction, the one-hour special that aired March 16th on the local ABC affiliate owned by Sinclair Broadcasting Group sounded like a must-miss, a sensationalized spree of fear and hate-mongering. I planned to avoid it. But on the Monday morning after it aired, I had a chance encounter with a colleague in a downtown crosswalk. She encouraged me to watch it because it's so bad. When I watched it later that morning, I couldn't help but yelp in frustration throughout the show. When people complain about tents and garbage in Seattle, I wonder whether they're bothered more by having to look at these visual signs of our community's failure or whether they actually care about the adults and children who live in those tents. The KOMO special by reporter Eric Johnson definitely appeals to the I don't want to have to look at the homelessness viewer. It's a call to punish rather than help people in need, and it seeks to divide them into the real homeless or the deserving poor and all the others. It's all the more disappointing given Johnson's reputation as a journalist. Yes, we need to focus on public safety and public health. We should be able to walk around our thriving city without harm. Small business owners should be able to operate in a climate that allows them to flourish. Police should be able to do their job of protecting the public. Kids should be able to play in parks free of needles. But at a time when our region needs to come together on solutions, KMO's program is a drastic, distorted, and divisive step backward. And I would kind of interrupt, sort of like the Depot Park deplorables arrival at City Council and their rage at the council, not because they've chosen Depot Park, but really because they've chosen any kind of solution for letting homeless people camp in a community together in Santa Cruz. Anyway, continuing with this article by Catherine Hinchinson. Here is what I find most objectionable about it, she writes. The Seattle is dying journalist Johnson appears to have started with a foregone conclusion, then set out to find sources to confirm it. There are no interviews with city officials, nor with people in government who manage the homelessness system. He doesn't talk to people working for nonprofits who could have told him about proven programs like Housing First and permanent supportive housing. And actually, I would probably disagree with her. I think these are token programs, but again, I'm not that familiar with Seattle. But I would think, generally speaking, this attempt to masquerade granting funding to Housing First programs is, it's been utterly insufficient, has to do with a cover for and an attempt to placate a nervous constituency that sees homelessness growing and doesn't want to see it anymore and also feels some compassion about it. But the Housing Now rhetoric has been all over Santa Cruz for a decade, led by sort of poverty pimp maestros like Don Lane, former council member, former mayor. And I say poverty pimp not so much because he makes a lot of money off of poverty. I don't think he does. But for years, it's been his shtick to be on boards of places like the Homeless Lack of Services Center that don't really provide services or provide increasingly less services to people, and that increasingly go along with the narrative of criminalize the homeless. I mean, the Homeless Lack of Services Center with its gated area, its ID checks, its elimination of meals for the broader community, its exclusionary policies, and supposedly its bogus pathway to housing is simply a hoax, because there isn't housing for this pathway. And what it was originally before the last decade or two, it was a place established for homeless folks to go as a sort of a day center, or initially to get a free meal, which now they can't even get a free meal at. You can only get into that if you are giving them a grant from the part of your check from the government, or you're part of a program that this center can be funded through the government for. And in any case, hence my nervousness about Housing Now, my criticism of Housing Now programs and so forth. not because I don't think housing isn't important, but because it's usually just simply a device for ignoring the reality that the real housing homeless people have are in camps right now. That's just where they are. And they need to be supported where they are right now until changes can be made of a fundamental nature in the society, if that ever happens. Continuing, however, with this critique of the Seattle is dying, which is important because it's filled the minds and gotten into the bile systems of lots of Santa Cruzans who came to City Council this Tuesday and the Tuesday before. The program conflates homelessness, that's the Seattle is Dying program, with drug use, mental illness, and crime, and attempts to paint a few individuals as representative of our entire homeless population. For example, there's a statistic that property crime is up, and Johnson insinuates without proof that it's because of homelessness. There's also an attempt to brand people who are homeless as violent. Crosscut's David Croman found that people who are homeless are disproportionately arrested and booked by the Seattle Police Department, similar to what's happening in Santa Cruz, and was used as a justification for this task force on public safety of some years ago, created by the mendacity of Deputy Chief Steve Clark, Chief Kevin Vogel, and the police department generally, which, though it now has this, I think, largely illusory, compassionate face of Police Chief Andy. He's Chief Mills is really continuing intensive police policies wherever there's any kind of complaints from merchants or residents, which I think he disputes. But when we try to hold him to account, for example, to instruct his officers not to go after folks in RVs just because somebody says, oh, they've been there for 72 hours, unless the person actually has been parked in an RV or a vehicle for 72 hours, not that they have any place else to park, mind you, in the city, because they don't, generally. There's no legal spots, really, if someone wants to complain about it, because the police will come out. Instead of advising the complaining neighbor, privileged housed person, look, you can't make a false complaint, because that's what we hear has been happening. You can't make a false complaint because you think you're nervous that there's somebody parked in front of your house in a public space. That itself is a crime. It's a misdemeanor to make a false complaint. You're claiming they've been here for 72 hours when they haven't. And Andy Mills, the chief, claims he has ways of knowing this. He's made that claim publicly in a press conference he had in a debate with Alicia Kuhl, an RV owner, an RV person who claimed to be repeatedly harassed by someone who Mills has celebrated as a great police officer, Joe Habe. In any case, homeless people, and we've been trying to show this at HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, are really either circumstantially disproportionately attacked, arrested, cited, moved along by police using a series of laws that were created for that purpose and indeed supported by police for that purpose. Can't sit down next to a building. You can't sit down within 14 feet of all kinds of things along Pacific Avenue. Again, the attempt to monopolize the public spaces for the tourist trade or for the convenience of people who find the look of homeless people something they don't want to see, or the look of countercultural people for something they don't want to see, for instance. Anyway, continuing with the story, Crosscut's David Croman found that people who are homeless are disproportionately arrested and booked by the Seattle Police Department. According to Croman's reporting, 1 in 5 jail bookings are of people experiencing homelessness. But the majority were for nonviolent crimes, including failure to appear in court. Conversely, Johnson profiles a man who assaulted a woman in SeaTac, an extreme example, but this is used as typical. We already know we have a woeful lack of mental health services here. Drug addiction, which can be a cause or result of homelessness, is a nationwide epidemic, not a Seattle-only problem, and it affects people with homes, too. Homelessness is decreasing nationally, but rising in cities where rents are too expensive. Of course, that's true here in Santa Cruz. But facts don't matter in this program, because instead we hear lively stories from the two people with lived experience who talk to Johnson, the young man who uses meth and reacts delightedly to hearing that he's on a list of the most frequent offenders, the woman who says 100% of people on the street are addicted because everyone she knows is. It's similar to people who think that here in Santa Cruz that all the people in Ross Camp are addicts. The program consistently dehumanizes people who are homeless, gratuitously and needlessly showing faces of those experiencing traumatic mental health or medical crises in public, calling them wretched souls, living like animals, in filth and degradation. It's unconscionable. Language like this causes a physiological reaction that inhibits our humane response to people who are homeless. Johnson says he doesn't seek to demonize people, yet he actually refers to one person as, quote, consumed by demons. The KMMO, Seattle is Dying narrative, suffers from the everywhere else does it better than we do syndrome. Johnson ignores our local progress, such as reducing family, youth, and veteran homelessness. He and his team travel to Rhode Island to devote a long chunk of the show to the successful prison-based medication-assisted treatment program. Had he sent his drones over the South Lake Union instead, he would have found permanent supportive housing programs like 1811 East Lake, a national model for alcohol treatment. Had he looked toward Belltown, these are places in Seattle, of course, I imagine, he might have found the respected law enforcement-assisted diversion program, which diverts people involved in low-level drug offenses to services. And again, we're talking about programs that I'm not terribly enthusiastic about, at least I imagine the Santa Cruz equivalent, but we don't even really have the meaningful equivalent. The notion of all these 10-year programs to end homelessness, throwing lots and lots of money in their direction, but not in any way really helping the people who are currently homeless out there to survive on a day-to-day basis, which is what they need, is really outrageous. But typical and standard, not just in Santa Cruz but elsewhere, but we live here, and this is where we have to address these issues. Johnson ignores the root causes of homelessness, both systematic and situational, the high cost of housing and wages that don't keep pace. Hello, Santa Cruz. Lack of health, mental health, and addiction services. Hello, Santa Cruz. Our regressive tax system, generations of racial discrimination, and hello, Santa Cruz. And long-term cuts in public housing, to name a few. Johnson criminalizes homelessness. His solution to the problem is enforcement and treatment, which on the surface may sound logical, but make no mistake, he's saying that the thousands of people who should be locked away, the people who are homeless should be locked away, because he then suggests spending our region's entire annual homelessness budget on turning McNeil Island, a remote confinement center for sex offenders, into a giant prison with drug treatment. I live in the beautiful city, the same beautiful city as Eric Johnson. But because I work on homelessness every day, I experience it differently. I hope that there's still a lot of work to do, though there is a lot of work to do. We can solve homelessness when business, academia, nonprofits, the faith community, funders, government, and more come together. Well, this woman has a lot more faith than I do. And again, this whole notion of solving homelessness instead of simply addressing where funding is going to poverty pimpery these days, and where people are being thrown into jail for simply being in public spaces. And until you address these basic issues and refunnel the money to those people, if that's what you want to do, you get it to them and not to people who are making a living off of them, such as I suspect Catherine Henriksen, who wrote this article, but who's saying some true things anyway. It's discouraging, she concludes, that KOMO did not look hard enough to see that there's more to the story than what's visible on the streets of Seattle. And it's not just discouraging. It's really enraging and depressing to hear the Santa Cruz City Council's oral communication session, which I'm going to play some of, probably not much of tonight, but certainly more of in the longer show I do on Sunday, assuming that I rev myself up to do it.
To the end of a long, long walk, when a man crawled out of a cardboard box under the E Street Bridge, followed me onto it. I went out halfway across with that homeless shadow tagging along, so I dug for some change. Wouldn't need it anyway. He took it looking just a bit ashamed. He said, you know I haven't always been this way. I've had my moments, days in the sun moments. I was second to none moments when I knew I did what I thought I couldn't do. Like that plane ride coming home from the war that summer. My son was born, memories like a coat so warm the cold wind can't get through. Looking at me now, you might not know it, but I've had my moments. Well, I stood there trying to find my nerve, wondered if a single soul on earth would care at all. Miss me when I'm gone. That old man just kept hanging around, looking at me, looking down. I think he recognized that look in my eyes. Standing with him there, I felt ashamed. I said, you know I haven't always been this way. I've had I've had my moments, days in the sun moments. I was second to none moments when I knew I did what I thought I couldn't do. Like that cool light on the E Street Bridge when a young man almost ended it. I was right there, wasn't scared a bit, and I held to pull him through. Looking at me now,
And that was Emerson Drive, I've Had My Moments, from a collection of sociallyconsciousmusic.com, if you want to check it out. All on YouTube. But now let's get back to Santa Cruz and sort of what is directly facing us. Let's get back to some voices from Ross Kemp. Here's one from the 18th of March. Now let's start on the 11th. I've been out there a couple times. I'll be going out there again soon. You know, listen in.
Okay, I haven't even had
any of the messages. So we're talking with, what's your name?
My name is Giovanna.
Joe, we're about to begin the meeting. You want to join the meeting?
Yeah, I'm talking to each other, though, and talking.
Sure, and I just want to say that even the landlords, they should not go against the American law. And they should let at least the sons and the daughters or grandchildren move in the apartment of the elderly, because the elderly need help too, and they can use their relatives to help them. Cool. In my case, they let my son be homeless just because they don't like him.
And we've been talking with?
I'm sorry?
Your name again is?
Giovanna Zamarchi.
Thanks, Giovanna. I'll be playing this on free radio probably on Thursday.
Okay, so when is the meeting there?
Meeting is now. We're having a meeting with, this is a council member. Right here. He's a council member.
Yeah, I think I saw him on TV.
And there's a meeting tomorrow with the city council at 7.
Yeah, because...
And this was, I think, on the 11th, as I said before. Every Monday, Drew Glover of the City Council had been coming out to chat with the Ross Kemp folks. He wasn't there this Monday because he was he's out of town. I think he'll be there next Monday. And, a couple of other council members have come out occasionally. I don't think I've seen Cynthia Matthews out there or... Mayor Watkins, but perhaps they came out at some different times.
So if we can establish one of that model and then one low barrier.
So here at the meeting now, we have about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 or 8 people, maybe less, because some folks are passing by as we're set up on the path here near the porta potties and the 4 wash stations that have showed up. We got Desiree, we got Mike, we got Drew, the city council member, we got Alicia, we have
Giovanna.
And Giovanna, who's here in a wheelchair.
I'm here also for my son. My son has been homeless. He worked all his life. He doesn't get no food stamp. He doesn't get nothing. And he's slightly handicapped.
Fair
and instead of helping him, they're just ignoring him. And even at housing, they say they don't care if the river is his blanket or he dies in the street. And that's wrong.
Thank you, babe. I got to get this group.
Okay. And as you can hear, I was eager to get the group meeting of which Giovanna was part of. But, you know, on listening to her in retrospect, a lot of what she says is very important and very specific information. It's good to hear it again. I don't know that the actual situation has changed, of course, which is really the key. And at Ross Kemp, you may find if you go out there, not just Ross Kemp folks, but also not just people who live there, but people who want to help who live elsewhere. That's what I found a week later on the 18th.
The Ross Kemp parking lot. We have 2 police vehicles and a large police substation and a ranger vehicle and 3 suspects here. What are you 3 up to?
We are going to distribute some fresh fruit and pads.
And where are you from? What communist group do you represent?
The People's Party.
Yeah. You are part of the people.
Yeah.
What's your name?
Stephanie.
And you are?
Valentine.
And you are?
Sam.
And how frequently do you folks come out?
Every Monday afternoon around 3 p.m.
Actually, that's where Drew Glover is about to show up here as a council member, you know, to chat with, you know about that.
Yeah, we asked him to show up last week. And
good for you. And now we'll see if he actually does something. Yeah. He failed to oppose the closing of the camp last week. Maybe this week we'll get a little cojones together. It could be. You never can tell.
And what I'm referring to is not the fact that Drew hasn't mentioned this issue at City Council, that the camp can't, shouldn't be closed until there is such a time as there's actually spaces for every single person that were in the camp that are accessible and available to them, or else leave them alone, both because that's the only humane and decent thing to do, but also because that's the law these days, given the constitutional decision in the Boise v. Martin case. But what Glover did instead was he let himself be sidetracked by staff members like Susie O'Hara, by Cynthia Matthews, and he never made the final resolution that made it very clear specifically that there was to be no movement out of the camp, no attempt to shut down the camp until it was very clear that there were spaces for everyone in the camp, and that that April 17th date was in essence rescinded until such time as they could show and document that that was the case. That was something that never became a resolution. Instead, we have an April 17th closing date actually moved up unofficially by City Manager Martine Bernal to April 10th, or he said he would begin closing the camp at that time. That was his letter to the community, which didn't get passed by the City Council, but as we know, the real power in the city is Martine Bernal, the city manager, and the folks he works with.
Anything you've seen in the last week that you want to pass on regarding either the camp or stuff around homeless civil rights issues?
The UN has a report out that it is against international law the way that we treat homeless people, and that's something that should be well known, that this is illegal, but we proceed to do it and violate international law just like everywhere else in the world with illegal wars and other kinds of war crimes.
Now, are you part of a group that meets regularly and discusses these issues, or are you just a bunch of individuals?
We're just a couple of communists that care about the low income and those who get fucked over by the bourgeoisie, I guess.
Terrorist agents of the international communist conspiracy?
Yeah.
They're just very modest, I think. And again, we've been talking with?
Stephanie.
And Valentin.
And occasionally
Sam.
Thanks.
So in a kind of desperation, the city council, eager to find adequate pretexts to close the Ross camp on April 17th, accepted the cover story of Susie O'Hara and Tina Scholl, two workers for the city manager, at the, I guess it was the March 19th city council meeting, that there would be adequate housing isn't the word, ground space or shelter for homeless folks on the 17th, because they would be reopening the very expensive Boneyard barbed wire campground along River Street or Highway 9 at 1220 River Street for 60 tents, and then a space for 50 cots on the ground in a dusk to dawn campground, or I should say, I don't want to use that word, it isn't really a campground, it is a campground, it's not an indoor, it's not a structure where you can be indoors, but it's not a place where you can be during the day, it's only a place you can come, bring your sleeping bag or get a sleeping bag, lie down, and then you leave at dawn, presumably, and it could be in the wee hours of the morning as the summer hours hit. So that's another 50 spaces. That's a whole 110 spaces. The campground is... Others have estimated it to be people like Alicia Kuhl went out there and counted 100 tents, of which she estimated 2 to 3 people in each tent, and then some of the tents are bigger than the small tents. That was a month or two ago, and the camp has gotten more crowded since then, though some have said that people have left out of fear that the camp is going to be abruptly depopulated. But obviously 110 spaces, even if it were accessible to everybody in the camp, and some drug users are not going to be able to go in there. Some other people are going to be afraid to go there because they feel it's too confining. Some people have work and they can't get to their jobs. Some people are afraid of hostility in the neighborhood, as we saw in great and militant force out in the Depot Park protest by the so-called Friends of Depot Park on the 26th of March at City Council. And also the week before, on the 19th of March, at the special city council session then. So there's just not enough room for people to go to, not enough places. So they can't really get rid of the camp legally on the 17th, but a lot of us think that's exactly what they're going to do. And on April 3rd, there's going to be a community response to try to support the campground in some way, whether it's to find them alternate spots to go to, and we're talking about public property. We're not talking about the idea that everybody takes home one homeless person and puts them up in a room somewhere. Although that's been proposed by some people in the past, and some people do it, and I've done it on occasion in the past, but it's no solution for hundreds of people who are outside, and it often can lead to a really serious disillusionment and embitterment if you take home someone you don't know and, you know, you feel ripped off later, or you don't like how they've treated you, or you don't feel you're getting enough gratitude. It's a form of charity rather than a form of acknowledging that a person has a right to shelter, a right not to be harassed, at least where they plop themselves down. And that's, of course, something that the people who are concerned about their property values and have these highly exaggerated paranoid fears about the safety of their children and so forth, but really concern is the aesthetic and kind of the wretchedness that goes with poverty. Something I don't want to see in their neighborhood or in their town. And it's not that they give a shit about the poor people there, or maybe they think they do, but the most important thing is that just not be in their neighborhood. Anyway, there was a gathering of such people at Depot Park last Sunday, and Alicia Cool, who is the liaison for the Ross Camp folks, she doesn't live at Ross Camp herself, she lives in an RV and has been struggling to assert the rights of the RV folks as well as to help Ross Camp people prepare a lawsuit that they're going to attempt to file to stop the city from its April 17th and even prior to April 17th attempt to run people off while giving them no real alternatives to go to. She and I had this conversation. So it's closing on 4 o'clock, 15 to 4, March 24th, I guess. And I'm talking with
Alicia.
And Alicia, you just came from the Depot Park shindig, where there were many folks who were intent on stopping the safe sleeping zone at Depot Park. We did a prior interview about some of the things you saw. You heard Drew Glover, the council member, talking. You saw Sandy Brown there. You also saw Brent Adams, who is an activist working with 24-hour storage. And I guess he had a table around. What was his focus?
He had some information on encampment. He had some information about transitional encampment.
Okay, and was he being well received? Do you think people were interested?
Well, I don't know how much. It was hard for me to gauge what the community liked and what they didn't like, as far as, you know, things that were mentioned. But he had a good crowd around his table, and he seemed to be talking to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Now, were there any other organized discussions going on about, let's say, what to do with City Council on Tuesday, which is coming up in 2 days? Although I've seen, as I said before, nothing on the agenda around homeless issues. Nonetheless, it is happening, and there is this sort of presumption that the city will proceed with, you know, the Lot 24 near the Depot Park. Were you actually into Lot 24? Were you walking Lot 24?
No, but I drove through Lot 24 to get there, because I kind of like went through the parking lot, went around, and came around to the circle to see where people were gathering. So I drove through Lot 24.
What was your analysis?
That that's a really, really terrible place to put that kind of a thing.
And why did you come to this conclusion?
Super close to the neighborhoods, totally visible from the soccer field. I feel like it's an unsafe location. It's too close to the road. People can probably throw things at people while sleeping over there. I mean, there's a lot of concerns.
Did you have much discussion with people about the Lot 24?
Yeah. I made you a favor.
Mm.
You can, next time order, you can tell, you can do that in your favor.
I'm going to steal one of them.
Yes, absolutely. Everybody hates the idea of Lot 24.
So, did anybody, and this is what you told me before, did anyone actually have any alternative suggestions?
Well, it seemed like San Lorenzo was a tad bit of a buy-in by from a couple of people that I spoke with. They weren't completely opposed to the Harvey West area, except for there was some mention of a Kirby school over there, so they were concerned about that. But they seemed to kind of lighten up when I told them that this camp would be a managed camp. They were kind of asking questions like, what makes this different than the Ross encampment? And I told them that it's organization and intention. The Ross camp kind of just was thrown together. This would be intentional, organized, managed, have security, things like that.
Now, we spoke before, shortly after 3 o'clock, or actually a little before 3 o'clock, but did you talk to many more people after we spoke?
I talked to a couple of people. I mean, I wouldn't say a ton, but a good couple of people. They have a couple of petitions going on there. They seem to have gathered a lot of signatures. I'm not sure exactly what they plan on doing about city council, like you asked, but I know that they're probably going to, at the very least, bring some attention to their petition. And I know I saw on a Facebook page one of the neighbors mentioned an injunction against the opening of that, but I don't know how serious they are for something like that.
At any point did you identify yourself as a supporter of the current Ross camp?
I identified myself to a couple ladies as the person that helped put together the Ross Camp Council, and I said that I was advocating for an encampment. So, yeah. I mean, not to every single person, but, yeah.
What was their response?
Kind of had some questions. Asked me questions about how, like, the next type camp, if we were to have an encampment, how would that be managed? I told them about the rules, that we wouldn't allow drugs and alcohol on premises, things like that.
Did that satisfy them?
Kind of, yeah.
Sarah, you were there as well. Don't talk with your mouth full, please. Did you have any alternate impressions? What were your impressions of the group, and what did you learn, if anything?
Well, one lady we were talking to, I educated her on a lot of the politics that was going on around town that she wasn't aware of, like the showers at the homeless center being down and how there's a serious lack of services. And we discussed how there's no available options and how the options and services that are offered are so limited. And I also explained to her that if we have very high barrier shelters, and the drug addicts and the mentally ill aren't going to have a place to go, and they're still going to be on the streets, that if we wanted to worry about public safety, we needed to prioritize the people who are actually causing the most problems and get them off the streets, or no matter how many encampments we have, public safety issues are never going to be addressed.
Did you encounter any hostile people?
Nope. Everybody was friendly and wanting to get to the bottom and talk and solve problems.
Yeah, I don't think it was a very hostile group at all. It seemed like, I mean, the closest thing I came to hostility was the lady who was managing one of the with petitions. I asked her if she'd be okay with, I said, is this against any encampment or is this against Lot 24? She started to tell me that it's against any encampment, but particularly Lot 24. And I asked her if she'd be okay with a location. And she kind of hesitated. I think she was trying to avoid just straight saying no, I would be okay with any location. So it took her a minute. She kind of came up with, I'd be okay with something in an industrial area.
So I gave her a minute to kind of, you know, expand on that idea, kind of waiting for her to throw something out. And I said, well, where? And she hesitated again, and she kind of got flustered and said, well, I don't really know. And that was it. So although they don't want Lot 24, they don't have a lot of suggestions. So I was trying to kind of spread around, you know, what do you think about Harvey West? You know, and try to at least plant that seed and see if we can gain some support for that area. Or at least what they think about that.
The woman that I spoke to was mostly concerned that Santa Cruz was having to carry the burden of the entire county's homeless population and very frustrated about having to jump jurisdictions and who's going to help and who's going to be accountable and how everybody's just trying to get out of solving the problem. A lot of people were frustrated by that.
So you said there, Alicia, you saw a lot of signatures on the petitions, and you probably looked at the petitions as well?
No.
How many signatures would you estimate there were on the petition?
Well, I mean, they had a couple 8.5. I mean, you have to tell me how many you think you can fit on an 8.5 by 11. Each one, I think, would have 2 to 3 pages. Mm-hmm. So that's how many signatures they had.
I think there's like 30 lines per page or something. I'm just guessing.
Mostly men, mostly women, a mixed group, families.
All different races, all different ages.
I didn't see a lot of different races. Maybe a few, but mostly white. A few mixed races, but like predominantly white, kind of like Santa Cruz is.
Well, 75% of the American population is white, and 12.5% is black, and 12.6%, a little bit higher, is Mexican. So if you take into that, there was a perfect.
I saw like a couple of Asian people,
well,
and like
fight over
and Drew. You know?
Very unseemly, you two.
And like, you know, a couple of people with the tan. It was mostly white there, I admit it.
Well, so it's. And that was a conversation with two activists, Alicia and her friend Sarah, who have been doing work out at the Ross camp to assist folks in getting together the lawsuit that would enable them to protect themselves from dispersal and to protect the communities from having people simply flung into their communities with no resources, no services, no bathrooms. Bathrooms continue to be shut citywide. In terms of traditional bathrooms at Loudoun Nelson, you need to be in a program. The city hall bathrooms remain locked down unless you are there for a particular event on an evening of a city council meeting or some other meeting where the, you know, they have to keep open the bathrooms lest the middle class piss in their pants. So that is an issue, an action that, an issue of the conscience in action has not been really focused on because of the Ross Camp situation, the emergency out there for those folks. But the bathroom situation is a crisis for people all over the city. I mean, as well as a public health crisis. If people can't piss in a bathroom, they take a crap in the bushes, you know. The attorney who's been advising folks out at Ross Camp, the Ross Camp Council, as it's called, folks who don't claim to really represent the Ross Camp entirely, but who are certainly individuals from it who are concerned with protecting their rights and also the rights of people more broadly in the Ross Camp. The attorney who's helping is general counsel, as he calls himself, is Anthony Prince, who came out to Santa Cruz, has been coming out on a regular basis every week, and who may be assisting the in pro per or pro se litigants, that is, people filing their own lawsuits, not with an attorney representing them, but on their own behalf, which we can still do in these communities, even if we want to. If we want to train ourselves or get the assistance we need to get that done, should be here next week to help do that. He had some thoughts on a number of issues which pertain to the rights of folks, and he, well, I'll just let him speak for himself. We had this conversation in the parking lot near Rouse Camp, where the security guard had previously harassed and demanded that Alicia Cool, who parked there with her family when she was going out to deliver water to the Rouse Camp, told her to leave, that she couldn't be there. This time, however, he was pushed back, didn't do that. And that was actually a phone call I got while making the show a moment ago with the word that we're making good progress on the lawsuit. So I should have a better report on that, if not on Sunday, then next week on next Thursday. And you can always learn more about it by coming to the Wednesday 7 p.m. meeting at the Resource Center for Nonviolence that's happening on April 3rd. And on the same day, of course, there's the weekly Conscience and Action meeting at 11, followed by the Huff meeting at 12, both of them at the Sub Rosa Cafe, which is on Pacific Avenue, across from the Yan Flower Restaurant next to the Bike Church. If you know where that is, you can check that out. Let's hear a little bit, though, from Anthony Prince and his thoughts on this and that and everything in between, or at least a few things in between.
So we're talking with or listening to...
Well, this is Anthony Prince. I was just going to tell Robert and Alicia a little story, but Robert pulls out his recording device and
you bet.
I have to be constantly on the alert.
Self-conscious.
So what we're talking about is how people's thinking changes. You know, how people substitute one idea for another and grow and consider things from a different perspective, do things they wouldn't ordinarily do because they have certain ideas that keeps them from doing it. So a few years ago, I remember reading about these two churches in Mississippi, some small town in Mississippi, had a black church and a white church. And still true today, majority of churches, especially Baptist churches, are separated by color, still in the Deep South. But these two churches had existed not too far from one another in a small Mississippi town for decades. One black, one white. Well, it got to the point, this is just a few years ago, that neither church could afford to remain open much longer because the members of each congregation had people losing jobs, economic hardships. They simply couldn't pay the bills to keep both churches going.
People wising up.
Let me tell my story.
Certainly.
So what happened was that they realized, well, we can't keep both these churches going, but we could keep one of them going. So the black church and the white church, the pastors sat down and met and said, well, we're going to have one church. We're going to sell one church, and with the proceeds of that, we'll be able to do a little work on the church that's remaining, and we're going to combine the congregations, the black congregation, the white congregation. So they agreed to do that because they had no choice but to do it. It was a question of losing both churches or bringing people together to save one church that they'd worship at in common. So the first service, there was nervousness. Blacks tended to sit on one side of the church, the whites on the other. Next Sunday, a little bit more intermingling. Then they had the after-church social and people getting to know each other. Oh, really? Your kid went there? Oh, yeah. Well, my kid plays football. Oh, what position? That type of thing. People talking. These are Southerners. They're talking about how to cook this and do that and all the rest of it. By the time they got rolling along, a few months later, it was absolute. I mean, they realized we're brothers. All men are brothers. All people are brothers. Visiting each other.
Or sisters, as the case may be.
The generic. But the point of it is that circumstances compelled them to come together. You know what I'm trying to say? It doesn't always have to be that.
Instead of compassion.
Well, but you know what? Compassion can grow from those circumstances. And I think it's not an either-or thing. It's both those things. And we're in a time period now where people are, whether they like a person or not, or whether they have a prejudice, or they thought these people are like this, and I'm like this, it's always been this way, they're finding themselves in different circumstances. And homelessness, which, of course, the majority of homeless people are there because they lost their housing, lost their jobs. They're not there by choice. It's an economic, you know, situation that compelled them, a family medical crisis that bankrupted them and sold everything, or they had any number of circumstances which result in a person becoming homeless. But there they are, living on a river bottom, or living in a park, or living in, you know, two or three, four families in one place, and forced together by circumstance. So when you're on a river bottom, and one's black and one's white, There's no basis to say that anyone's better than anybody else. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
How can you have a perspective that some person, because of his color or his background or her position or this or that, is any better or any different? So we're convinced that it's in these homeless camps and in the whole circumstance of this increasing, just this huge proliferation of homelessness, that we're going to find the circumstances to bring people together. They come together out of necessity, not necessarily by choice, but they remain together as they learn about one another. And as they struggle together, struggle for their common good. Because if the camp's going to be destroyed, everyone's going to suffer. You know what I'm trying to say?
Right.
So that's what we're finding increasingly. This is the birthplace of a new movement, and we're going to take advantage of these circumstances. So that's all I have to say. And
well, I have something to say here.
What? Of course, has something to say.
I occasionally comment, as you may know. Now, earlier today,
we
were sitting in Java Java Junction, where the hell this place is, working on this lawsuit, which is details which I'll not reveal at this time. However, it may be coming up soon. And there was the owner of the cafe approached the table. And he kind of wondered what was going on. I, in my innocence, invited this guy to sit down. He's sort of an outspoken fellow around the issue of, you might call him a bigoted fellow, but on this issue he's pretty upset about loss of business in the Ross camping center, the shopping center. Bad behavior, his different employees being scared. And he said this has also happened at different businesses. I was going to ask him, when was the last time it happened? Is it happening more recently? Just kind of get more information. But I didn't really get into that at this time. But you earlier suggested, because there is a kind of a rally today of those who are opposed to the Depot Park and certainly supportive of the elimination of the Ross camp, that we reach out to those folks in some ways to try to point out that there are common interests, so there seem to be some real class divisions here still. I mean, there obviously are. And yet, you became very angry and upset at his tone to you, which was sort of, because he didn't know who you were first. You're an out-of-towner, how would you know what the hell is going on, was his attitude. And you're at it with, what the fuck are you doing sitting at our table, just kind of mosey in here. I mean, you know, and then you mentioned that you were an attorney. I thought, oh, he's playing the attorney card. But in fact, you then later talked about this issue. We moved to another place to eat, or to talk, actually. We didn't eat, and to work on the lawsuit that we're working on. And you said that this really is a really important issue of dehumanization, and it seemed to spring not just from some intellectual basis, which I have a lot of my stuff is based on intellectual stuff, but really there's a passion that you have, a certain anger that you have, that is involved in this. Mm-hmm. You want to talk a little bit more about that? Stop that.
Well, no. Well, it's just a question of the union's perspective is that on the one hand,
the homeless union,
for which I'm general counsel, so I certainly have a legitimate business here in Santa Cruz. We were asked to come in here and assist persons who are at the Ross camp in pushing back against the city's plan to destroy the camp. And so that's what we're doing. So we certainly have been invited in, and we're going to carry out our commitment so long as the members of the union...
Do you love Desiree's shirt?
Oh, yeah. As long as they're willing to carry out their end of it. So we're going to stand up for ourselves. We don't like to be pushed around. On the other hand, we are reaching out because I think the city of Santa Cruz is only too happy to see homeowners fighting homeless. You know what I'm saying? They're only too happy to see that. I think there is common ground here. But the common ground has to be on the basis of some respect. And the whole strategy of, unfortunately, of the system we live in is to dehumanize those who they no longer have a need for. And homeless people are being every single day subjected to just absolutely, just indefensible dehumanization, such as in Yuba County, where we had a Yuba County code enforcement officer call a woman living in her RV who was legally parked on private property with the permission of the owner of the private property, nevertheless called her a
fucking piece of shit.
Well, actually, what he called her was a fucking homeless piece of shit. That's the thing that's critical, is that the word homeless now has become, I won't say synonymous, but approaching the level that the N-word has been used historically to completely dehumanize a whole segment
that's
of
the word nigger,
population.
Folks.
That's correct. And so that word now is being brought in to convince the public that homeless is synonymous with criminal, homeless is synonymous with a lower order, such that you can actually compare them or actually categorize them as pieces of human excrement.
So what advice do you give Alicia, who today may be going to the...
We're going to get in the camera, right?
She's going to the Depot, Friends of the Depot Park rally at City Hall, which is, there's a city council meeting today. But and you're hoping that she can reach out somehow to the people who are the leaders of this to encourage what?
Well, I think there ought to be, let's first of all, pull back from some of the rhetoric. It's a complicated problem. It's a systemic issue of people being homeless. I think that that there's common ground. I would say let's just sit down and talk. We do not favor the idea of plunking people down in a parking lot that they have to fold up their tents and wander around like pack animals all day with everything they own and then come back at night into a parking lot. We don't think that that's a way to treat people, and the community has concerns about something like that being created in the midst of their community. And I think let's listen to each other. Let's see if we can work some things out so that they recognize that the city has legal obligations and certainly resources to provide something more than a parking lot or or something along those lines. And homeowners also have an interest in their neighborhoods, and I think we can reach some common ground. So I would suggest that people try to cool things out, more light than heat, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, but
well,
Mr. Attorney,
what
it's
can
a,
I say specifically as a, far as like you know the guy how he said you know,
let's end this and let's get in there because I got to get on the road, carry out all my assignments. That I just
we can even do this off the record. But what should I say when they say things like you know drug use? What about the drug?
Yeah, what about
use?
The what drug about, users, Mr.
What about when people are messing up my bathroom?
I would say that if people are breaking the law, that there's law enforcement should act.
Yeah, the police won't come anyway.
Don't
so
arrest. Don't ascribe to an entire group of people the misconduct of a smaller minority. Of those
people.
Gotcha. There you go.
We're not responsible for everybody.
And she'll catch you on the phone to give an argument if necessary.
We're responsible for ourselves. And that's because it's me.
Off to the Ross camp.
I pull myself out of my tent.
With Desiree.
Born with a microphone.
It seems that way, actually.
That was the interchange with Anthony Ross. Here's a little bit from the Ross camp.
I think he was born with that.
You know, some people just make a decision.
Where is the umbilical one?
And I'm being criticized by microphone.
I think you're awesome. Oh,
that's Desiree.
I like your feet. Your input.
Trash cans. Yeah, me too. Looks like more trash cans and less porta potties.
Yeah.
So we're gonna get Michael then.
Yeah.
And three wash stations and eight porta potties. Talking with what's your name?
Lowry Billy.
Sorry, Billy. And you said you got previously where you were living, you were given a 7-day notice.
Yeah, at the park. And he came in a day early.
Depot Park or San Lorenzo?
San Lorenzo. And he came in a day early and caught everybody by surprise and just started mowing tents down.
Now, this was at San Lorenzo?
Yes.
About what, a year and a half ago?
No, that was when they kicked us out.
That was more recently?
Yeah.
And they sent you here?
Well, no. We just started separating and going, you know.
Different places?
Yeah.
How long ago did you come here?
About...
Who's this? Is this your
job? No, that's mine. About two.
Can I sit on it?
Yeah.
Actually, the Ross camp became more visible after the precipitous closing, the unexpected closing, the betrayal in the minds of some of us that was the closing of the River Street Boneyard Barbed Wire Campground, which I was a constant critic of because it did provide for a 24-hour least the right to be there. You had to come in and out through vehicles that were a schedule organized by the city. You couldn't have visitors. Your tents were placed right next to each other with no privacy, really. I mean, there was the privacy of the individual tent, which actually is a step forward, but the place was so cramped and crowded that it was
you know, you had people snoring in the next tent and so forth. Actually, kind of was similar to what is now happening at the Ross campground because, in essence, so many people either joined folks who were there or were directed there by police in the fall of last year. And some of them initially went to San Lorenzo campground, but that was, I should say, San Lorenzo Benchlands and San Lorenzo Park. But that was made illegal, or it has been illegal for decades to be there, based upon laws that are simply designed to clear the area of all poor people who have to sleep outside at night in any visible public spots, and probably lots of not-so-visible public spots. And so this is Billy talking more about his situation.
2 months now.
And did that you come directly from San Lorenzo?
Yes.
So, sir,
no,
sir.
I went on where the shelter is, and then I came over here.
Okay. So I interrupted your account of how you were given a quick, 7-day notice?
7-day notice, and then they... he came in a day early and caught us by surprise and started mowing the tents down. You have people that just got tents, brand new tents that their parents bought them. They ain't had it a week, and he just mowed them down.
And I believe he's talking about the tents at San Lorenzo Park, where he went before he moved first to the shelter and then ended up in Ross Camp, where he is now.
And this was
over in San Lorenzo Park about 3 or 4 months ago? And who was this? Police? Parks and Rec?
Yep. I have proof that I had took everything I had 6 times. Everything.
At different points in the last few years?
Yes. And I ain't got none of it back. None of it.
Have you attempted to get it back?
I don't have to. That's my property.
No, I understand.
Yeah, you know.
And have you gone to the cops between 12 and 2 on Tuesdays and Thursdays, which is when they're open? And
no.
Blah, 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 blah.
That's what they want you to do.
Of course.
Yeah. They shouldn't have took it in the first place.
Of course not.
Of course not.
So the way they took it, they should have brought it back.
Yeah. Of course they should.
That's not the... But the issue is, you didn't follow the rules, so we don't have to bring it back to you.
What rules? Well, if they followed the rules, then they know that the park isn't supposed to be closed. The lady gave the park to the city of Santa Cruz, and she made only one request. And that request was that this park remains open at all times.
They've been ignoring that since 1984.
Thank you. And it's grandfathered in. You can't mess with nothing that's grandfathered in.
You're here now, and you've been here for a while.
Yes.
What are you going to do when they try to start moving people out on April 10th? That's what this attorney's here to talk about.
Yeah.
Well, join us if you want.
Look, you can tell him.
Yeah.
Everybody know I started the tents in the park.
Oh, okay. You can tell him that, too.
Yeah, and... First, it started off with 2 umbrellas.
Yeah.
They said I couldn't have 2 umbrellas.
Doggy doggies.
And that was B.B. King from a 1974 version of Why I Sing the Blues, recorded apparently live in Africa. You're tuned to the stream of Free Radio at freakradio.org, possibly an archive. I'm Robert Norse, and urging you to get in touch with us to let us know where we can find a 10x10 space, indoors or outdoors, to set up equipment so we can reestablish our studio, our phone line. And you can actually call us during the show, pass on actual information, engage in real dialogue with us, get your voice out there as well as ours. You can also, of course, get your voice out by becoming a broadcaster, and that's easy enough to do. All you have to do is go to the website, freakradio.org, download an application, or you can give me a call if you want some assistance with that. I'm one of the members of the collective at 423-4833. You can also call me if you have any idea where there might be a 10x10 space, preferably indoors, but also outdoors. We can build our own structure. We need access to electricity, internet, and a bathroom. It would be good to be on a public transportation line. Should be in the Santa Cruz area somewhere. You get $300 for that. If you can find it for us, we can use it for a year or lesser amounts if we use it for a lesser period of time. We're also looking for a place to put up our antenna so we can once again return to the airwaves. We're currently not on the airwaves, although I think that's due to happen soon. But if you've got an idea of a tall tree near where you live or where a friend of yours lives or a high house, by which I mean a house that has a high elevation, if you follow what I mean, then let us know. 423-4833. That would be helpful for us, too, because, we can use all the help you can give us. So next we're going to look in on the Santa Cruz City Council meeting of last Tuesday, which was the afternoon session was your usual afternoon session, perhaps shorter than usual. Started at 3:15, went till 6 or so. We've had some very long afternoon sessions. But the evening session, for some reason, they put nothing of consequence on the evening session except oral communications, which Watkins uncharacteristically expanded to an hour, probably because, and one could only speculate here, she was accommodating a large number of Friends of Depot Park, which is to say NIMBYs exacerbated by, upset by the possibility that there'd be a dusk-to-dawn campground for 50 people opening on April 17th, or supposedly opening on April 17th, according to that mistress of broken promises, Susie O'Hara, or smiley-faced Sue, as I sometimes derogatorily called her. She's a nice person, by the way, but I just don't like the way she serves as the mouthpiece for the city manager's office to the detriment of the homeless community and really to the broader community as well. So there was a big rally of Friends of Depot Park before. Also, Food Not Bomb showed up even before that, wanting to kind of slip in before the Depot Park rally. But the Depot Park numbers, I should say, the numbers of people who were roused to come to this oral communications period where the council can't really do anything. They just get to hear from the community. I mean, they could, and they do, put stuff on the agenda if the city council members get off their duffs and put stuff on the agenda. But it looked to me like this was somewhat stage managed by Cynthia Matthews, who I regard as the shadow mayor of the city council, as I've said before on this show. Even though she has technically a minority, only Donna Myers and Mayor Watkins are on her three-person side of the council, the others being Cummings, Glover, Crone, and Brown. Nonetheless, that group splits away, and the only real, well, it varies from time to time, but Cummings voted, for example, against rent control and the rent freeze. He initially voted to close down the camp on the 15th of March, and then he was able at the next meeting to be persuaded by some of us and others more influential perhaps than myself to not only to essentially rescind that date. But then again, more recently, he's supported the 17th of April date as closing, again, all without any real tangible proof and evidence, even in the face of some limited questioning by Drew Glover of Susie O'Hara, who's the council's go-to person supposedly for all this campground space that's supposedly going to be available on April 17th. Anyway, I'm going to play a little bit of the oral communications period. Not much, because I want to get other stuff in. And it's, you can find it online at the city's website, and it's also pretty nasty stuff, except there's some speeches by myself and others that is, of course, I think cover the issue or some of it. We actually didn't get a chance to cover it. I asked for 4 minutes for the normal time for a group presentation. For the first time, Watkins refused that. Actually, she refused apparently all group presentations, or perhaps nobody else asked for one. But I'm going to just give you a taste of the kind of rather nasty stuff that was being spoken at the oral communications, and we'll play a little of that now.
Hi, my name is Natalie, and I live in the Mary Lagoon Apartments. I have a 4-year-old little girl who walks every single morning at 7:30 a.m. through the Beagle Park, and I don't want her to see that kind of environment where possibly people are doing drugs right in front of her. And I also work for First Alarm at downtown Santa Cruz at Walgreens, and I constantly deal with them shooting up and being aggressive towards me. I also walk home every single day, super late at night from school and work, and it would feel very unsafe to be there. And especially when they already recognize me from work and are constantly cussing me and yelling at me. So I don't think it's a really good idea for them to put them right by my home where I should feel safe to walk home every single night and from school. Thank you.
And a lot of clapping after each of these statements. Of course, a person working for First Alarm whose purpose is to drive away homeless people from public spaces illegally, I might add, given the court decision, and unnaturally shove people out into the rain and force people away from traditionally protected spaces like outside the library and at City Hall. Yeah, they get a lot of flack. They should. They should get even more flack than they're getting. But there wasn't really much specific evidence of actual crime around the Depot Park area. And all of it, again, is vaguely phrased. The homeless is kind of them. And this is kind of this monster from Ross Camp is coming to eat you, you know. It's comic if it were not such a dangerous kind of false representation, a menace being created that steals people to feel justified in being angry and violent and cruel to people outside who have it a hell of a lot worse than they do. Here's another oral communications.
My name's Aaron Singleton O'Neill. I'd like to know an answer. What do you guys know about property management laundering? Or voting on... What do you guys know about property management laundering? Or voting on a group of citizens to chase me around, terrorize me, torture me? What kind of city we have here? You know, you guys should be ashamed of yourself, and I'm going to just really kick the hell out of the city because of this shit.
And that somewhat inarticulate and kind of brief, angry statement, I take it was from a homeless guy who's been feeling harassed. It wasn't what I intended to play, because the overwhelming majority of the comments were angry, generic attacks on homeless people as junkies, brutes, animals, public safety menaces, and so forth.
You're stealing my land too, my family's land.
Name is Barry Kirshen, and I'm a Beach Hill neighbor of Depot Park, and I'm here tonight to express my disappointment in the lack of public process opportunities for neighbors to weigh in before a decision is made. I recall hearing about the sites that you were considering a couple weeks ago, and my reaction was that none of them were appropriate, and certainly not Depot Park. Thank you.
And that, of course, was the mantra of almost everyone who spoke. Even the people who are on the side of the Ross camp were very critical of this, of the very few sites proposed by the city. There are some 530 or 40 or 50 properties the city has. They narrowed it down to six. Everything else was inappropriate, including everything Drew Glover suggested or Chris Krohn suggested. And it's like they created a whole situation that was intentionally, and this is Keith McHenry's belief, designed to cause a kind of backlash by the community and mobilize this hostile anti-homeless attitude, which isn't just about Depot Park. It's about anywhere in Santa Cruz. And that will be, I'm going to be exploring that further when I talk at you again on Sunday, I think, assuming that I can't find something better to do with my Sundays. So I'm a fan of public input, and I supported the position that there should be public input before a spot is chosen. The reason they're rushing it, of course, is they want to dump the Ross camp on the 17th, and they know that legally they're on questionable ground if they try to do that without adequate shelter. They're on totally inadequate ground, even with the Depot Park site and the Boneyard site, too, which they set up. Plus, they would add, oh, well, we have the 7th Avenue shelter, and we have the Laurel Street shelter. But, of course, the problem with that is that these are also have to serve the other 500 to 1,500 homeless people who are in Santa Cruz outside the Ross camp even now. And so it's a ridiculous situation for them. And instead of honestly facing it, it looks like what they want to mobilize is enough public hostility to the homeless. If you view this as a conscious effort, I don't even know if it's that. I was about to give a call to activist Keith McHenry to get his opinion on it. Maybe we'll hear about that on Sunday. I wasn't able to reach him today. Instead, I'm going to turn to some of the conversations I had prior to the city council meeting, where there was, as I said, a large, almost the largest I've seen in years, gathering of people who are mobilized. I take it by someone like Lynn Renshaw, a property owner, and I assume she's a property owner. She's certainly a NIMBY resident of the area, I think, who wanted to bring people in to express a really strong community hostility toward the city's decision to open a place at Depot Park. And I can appreciate, again, public accountability is really an important thing, but there is somewhat disingenuous because I don't think this crowd wanted this anywhere, neither in their neighborhood or in any other neighborhood. I think they'd come forward and oppose it in other neighborhoods too. Again, using the false notion that children are threatened or that there's going to be a crime problem or that it will be inhabited by junkies or this sort of thing is... It's misleading in a number of ways. These city-run or church-run programs are very exclusionary, and for that reason, they will not draw people, some of the people away from Ross Camp anyway. They'll simply, ironically, because they don't allow a low barrier entry by people who are addicted to various drugs, addicts at this time, they'll hit the other neighborhoods. They'll go somewhere else in the Santa Cruz area. I suppose you might say, well, maybe they'll leave town. Yeah, maybe, and maybe not. Again, the idea here is if people can be strong-armed and frightened and bullied and hostilized out of town. You know, tough love. I'd call it kind of nasty hate rather than tough love. So what I'll play for you now is one hostile to the homeless individual followed by Abby Samuels and then me speaking as the last two speakers to give you a sort of a sense of how oral communications concluded from the audience side.
No, I'm sitting here because I can't stand.
Similarly here.
Okay, we'll have you, and then if you could identify me in advance that you're in line, because we've had folks waiting in line.
I did.
I didn't get the notice.
I sent you an email.
Well, we'll go ahead and have it just because of the fact that you were unable to stand.
Thank you.
I suppose the last few years, but you can go ahead.
That's Mayor Watkins. I've been sitting in the front row for an hour instead of standing in line along the side of the wall. I sent her an email telling her I wanted to speak on behalf of a group. I got an email back saying, you can speak for, they'll be speaking for 2 minutes at oral communication. I sent her another email that said, wait a minute, what's going on? Why aren't people allowed to speak for groups? And I got a response back from the mayor's assistant saying, can't really tell you about that, I don't know. And so Watkins apparently had either not been kept informed of all this, or had forgotten it, or possibly didn't give a shit, or was... But in any case, when she was pressed, and I did intend to press her, that's for sure, I think, she relented and allowed one woman, Abby Samuels, who was on crutches, and myself, who's getting more feeble as the days lengthen, but still walks around, stands around, but I also try to sit around a lot to speak up at the mic.
I'm going to go ahead and close it. I doubled the time for oral communications. We've received numerous emails. You're welcome to email us and continue. I apologize. I know many people wanted to speak tonight. We'll go ahead and extend it for the remaining of three speakers.
Okay, thank you.
This is horse shit. There was the city council ended early. She could have easily allowed the oral communication to go on for another half hour, another hour. She could have easily done it in the civic auditorium so people did not have to press themselves up to the windows outside. This is the same routine Mayor Watkins has been doing for the last four or five council meetings. She has excuses at each time. This time she didn't even bother with an excuse. Something about the city council, the civic auditorium tiling was not adequate. But again, if we are to be fair about this or realistic about it, we have to understand that this is also the fault of the council majority, which is Brown, Crone, Cummings, and Glover. They could pass a resolution. This next thing will be held at the civic auditorium or a large building somewhere. That's just how it's going to be. They could direct the staff to do that, or they could direct the city manager to direct the staff to do that, understanding there would be likely a large crowd, and they'd anticipated this. But they don't seem to, as we say, have the balls, or in Brown's case, the ovaries, to do that. So we're stuck with this. Anyway, this is the NIMBY speaker, followed by Samuels and then me, I believe.
Martine, I was at a party with you at my best friend Laura McLeod's house when you were being elected. We had a really nice conversation actually about this. And I'm sorry to you guys, I didn't have an intention to speak tonight. I just wanted to come in here because I live two blocks from Depot Park. And I just wanted to say that I'm sorry this fell into your lap when you were elected. This has to be horrible. And it's a community problem. We're all scared. We're all worried.
Why would they be scared? Maybe you're scared. Maybe you're worried. And no, it's not a new problem. And it didn't fall in anybody's lap. It's been sitting there for years as the situation goes worse and worse, and privileged property owners, perhaps like this speaker, allow a situation to get worse and worse and allow profiteers who own property to make lots of money while other people lose their housing and become homeless. Well, you know, jobs flee.
We all don't want it. You don't want it. So I want us to all work together, and I know that you want that too, because I know what you stand for, and you're a really great woman, and I voted for you, and I'm glad that you're here. But my biggest concern is we live there. This one is terrified to go anywhere downtown. We live on Lincoln Street. And we've lived here 22 years from New York, and this is by far, as you know, again, I'm not saying anything you guys don't know, it's super scary, and I just don't...
Again, it's supposed to be common knowledge that it's super scary to be outside at night. I don't think the average Santa Cruzan does think it's super scary, but the people they brought here are creating that narrative. Again, I have no counter evidence or polls to show that.
Know where the police are in any of this. Like, I get a parking ticket in front of my own house because I haven't paid my permit parking. But I just, I don't know why I'm, you know, I'm.
And that permit parking in front of her own house denies poor people in their vehicles the right to park there. She's paying for a privileged seizure of the public property as well. And, of course, she's complaining about it. Well, if you want to make it your private spot, which is what Cynthia Matthews did 20 years ago when she initiated the creation of permit parking as part of the attempt to run homeless people out of neighborhoods, then you have to pay the consequences. Occasionally, you have to pay for a permit. You don't have to run around at night looking for a place to sleep because you've got one.
Like the criminal in this town, and I pay a lot of money to live here, as do all of these people we pay.
Yet those who deny people rights and who insist on their own privileges at the expense of the survival of other people are criminals. Really very serious criminals. It's just they don't see it themselves, or they prefer to be willfully oblivious to it. Their crime has to do with very more profound violations of human rights or enabling those who do. And you're going to hear her praise the police and wonder why they're not out there. She wouldn't put it this way, but kicking more homeless butt.
Premium prices to live here. And in our backyard, we have horrible, scary, really sick drug addict. And it is a drug epidemic. It's more than a homeless epidemic because I don't know that most.
This is an oft-repeated mantra, but, you know, what's the story of drug arrests, busts, or even complaints in the Depot Park neighborhood? I mean, I'm curious. I don't have any evidence, but you would think that if they have evidence, they would give it other than simply recite anecdotal scary stories and say, oh, well, we all know that this is true.
Most of the homeless veterans, and I can't speak for this, I don't know that they would set foot in these camps. They're terrible. It's horrible. I do feel awful for all of you that this is happening. And
she feels awful for the city council. Not for the homeless, but for the city council. This is again, you know, her friend Martine Watkins is someone she's very concerned about. Poor Martine Watkins, who has no place to go home to tonight. Oh, wait, I guess she does, doesn't she?
I just hope we can work together, and I do hope that the police get a little more okay to help. Thank you.
And by that, she means to help them out, far out. I'd have to assume, based upon the rest of what she says.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Abby. About 8 years ago, I was also, I don't know if you know this, but I was also extremely afraid of people that were living on the streets. Very afraid. I couldn't look at them in the eyes because my reasoning was they wanted something from me, and I didn't want to start a conversation. I was afraid. There's multiple reasons. But I decided at one Christmas I started giving out food, and that Christmas changed my life at the vet center. And what happened was, it was unbelievable. People were saying God bless you. Everyone, almost everyone, said God bless you for a piece of food. And I experienced this all the time. And what's changed for me is now I have found more humanity in the people at the camp, and I'm willing to stay there for 1 week straight every single night, I promise. I've gone to that camp, I speak to the people, I feel extremely safe. So I think that people are afraid of what they don't know, just like I was 8 years ago. And I feel more humanity with the people in the camp, and what they're more alive and in touch with life, whereas most of us, including myself, a lot of the time are at home in their safe environment with the TV or whatever's going on, where I get lost into what's the moving of life. And I do not agree that most of the people at the camp are drug addicts. I do not. Seattle, I've been talking to people in Seattle, city council people.
And, of course, Abby also doesn't have stats. We don't have stats about who are drug addicts in the camp, how many there are. We hear Brent Adams' assertions that a strong majority, if not an overwhelming majority, are. I think he said that on this show. And we've had others say, no, not so much at all. I don't know. But I know that anybody has a right to shelter, period. And if you're going to drive them away from here, there, and everywhere else, then they go where they have to go. And there's just such a thing as some basic human decency, and that's the reality of it. That's the, kind of for me, the bottom line. But again, I don't have the other figures. I think we really need figures if we were going to talk about it intelligently. But the issue is not a drug addiction. The issue is criminal violations. And I don't mean shooting up. I mean the violation of theft, violation of assaults. I mean the violations of abuse of other people. And when you have a class war going on in the city between this housed population, which is really determined for the benefit of its own real estate values to drive homeless people away, and acting that way towards the homeless population, you're going to get pushback, and you should get pushback. People need to be encouraged to stand up for themselves as human beings, and that's what I urge people to do. It's a natural consequence of some folks feeling they have more privileges than others. That's what I think.
And looking up statistics, and there's opposing sides where people say that the crime has gone up and the crime has stayed the same. I know you're going to cut me off. Thank you.
I noticed that no one who's spoken here in opposition to the Depot camp, and I'm no fan of the Depot camp myself, mind you. It's not an encampment. It's a nighttime-only proposal. But no one, except for one speaker, has offered an alternative spot. So what we're really saying is, get the fuck out of town. That's what's really being said here.
I want to remind you that there's children.
I understand.
And I want to.
And the kind of bigotry that is being pushed here is not particularly healthy for children, in my view. Okay? You got that? That's bigotry. That's dangerous stuff. You have a mob of people here who are believing in fantasies, dangerous paranoid fantasies about people who are in trouble, some of whom are drug using. Yes. What do we got? As far as the Ross Camp Depot Park issue, it's pretty clear. Driving people out of Ross Camp into the streets, sidewalks, parks, green belts, and residential neighborhoods, which is what's going to happen, folks, if they close the Ross Camp on April 17th. Our city manager has already declared that on the 10th he's going to start clearing out the camp with no place for people to go, fundamentally. Okay? That's the point. So what you need to do is acknowledge this. The $90,000 per month River Street camp for 60 people, no. Even if the depot site continues, which I don't think it's going to, given this outcry, and I understand it, it's not going to be available for enough people in that camp. So what have we got? The community needs to come up with its own solutions. Everyone's invited to the Resource Center for Nonviolence, April 3rd, 7 p.m. Of all kinds of views, opposing the depot, opposing the homeless, whatever you oppose, this is a community problem, as many speakers have said. Now, anyone who'd like to speak on free radio, and I've been running around with my little machine here recording some dialogues and some opinions. Apologize, I haven't gotten to everybody. I'm interested in your view. Contact me. I've given out this flyer in case you want my number. We'll put you on the air. Whatever your view, we need real dialogue and real action. The only viable place right now, however crowded and wretched, is Ross Camp. The only realistic alternative tonight. That's what we got.
And I essentially was the last speaker, which actually got a smattering of applause. Impressive, considering that almost every opposition speaking got overwhelming applause. But I suppose that that was a well-planned effort on the part of the opposition. And we're going to kind of round this out with a brief statement from a guy who came to the longest ever Huff meeting that we had yesterday at the at the Sub Rosa Cafe next to the bike church. Come again next Wednesday, and you can witness this yourself and be a part of it. Dave. Dave's a pseudonym. He didn't want to give his real name because he was afraid of discrimination. But here's what he has talking about. This spread of bigotry and bigoted attitudes into the businesses downtown, specifically the Santa Cruz Coffee Roasting Company on Pacific Avenue.
2:30.
No, they won't even hear about it, probably. I wish they did. But okay, we're talking with...
Dave Davis.
And Dave Davis, you've just been at the Huff meeting, and you have something to note about the coffee roasting company.
Oh, when I came into town, I wasn't... as long as I was a stranger, I'd go in there every night or every day and buy a cup of coffee. I'd come in other times to use the bathroom. Nobody said nothing, or to come in with the previous night's coffee to finish that off before I buy a refill and charge my phone. But once I was seen talking to a homeless lady, I showed up the next day. The game was changed. I got grandstanded. I got yelled at. If you're going to come in here and use our bathroom and charge your phone, you know, at least you could do is buy something. Well, before they perceived me as being homeless, that wasn't the case. This is outright class discrimination. This is a symptom of how bad the discrimination is getting against.
Now, what day did this happen?
Today.
And you say that yesterday you talked to a homeless woman, and you think that was one of the reasons they might have done this?
Yeah, because she's a regular homeless older lady that I like talking to. That carries a didgeridoo, and we came walking in from Front Street through the place yesterday talking, and stopped, paused, and talked to some of her friends at a table. I knew we were being watched. I knew they were taking note eyes with her. And I could anticipate what was going to happen next. It's so predictable with this class discrimination thing going on basically all over the United States right now. And so as soon as I was perceived as being one of the homeless, the next day I get grandstanded, publicly humiliated, you know, emotionally duressed. I mean, I could go on and on. I was planning on buying another cup of coffee, but I was finishing off yesterday's coffee that was in my cup that I left in my car when I woke up.
A likely story, Dave, as you might
right.
say.
Now, I had their cup and their lid, right?
Now, you knew another Dave, one-ton Dave, who you were friends with. Yeah. At one point, you got him a cup of coffee from a much, rather popular so-called hippie joint years ago. What was the name of that place?
The Java House, ran by Kevin. Yeah, Wonton Dave was banned from the Java House for his like totally legitimate homeless activism. He was a law student that didn't pass the bar, and he fought back. He eventually passed the bar while he was fighting the city. And then I used to buy him coffee and run it outside to him, where he used to sit in the sidewalk and read books and not bother nobody. Pretty soon, I'm getting threatened with being banned from a coffee house for buying a guy coffee.
Banned by Kevin or by his associate?
Kevin, not Phineas. The guy looked like Phineas Freak. I forget what his name was.
I remember his way he looked like.
He looked like Phineas Freak from the Furry Freak Brothers, but he was mean. Well, Phineas and the Freak Brothers was kind of... Anyways, that's the whole stuff. So this class discrimination, I can't even buy a guy a cup of coffee that they don't approve of because he's homeless, or they're going to send me out just like they do to the untouchables in India. Help an untouchable, you're an untouchable.
Have you been back throughout this period of time, or have you been elsewhere?
I've had to live in Arizona for years because of a lung condition, you know, that I picked up chronic bronchitis while surviving being homeless myself at one time. You know, so I ended up having to spend the winters in Arizona now and stuff, you know, and I'm older. But, I come back into town once in a while, notice that surveillance is on me within 2 days. They know I'm in town somehow. That's thanks to the downtown host program they founded, which is really just domestic spying on the poor, you know.
They're just trying to keep tabs on you, Dave. And, of course, the hosts are, I guess they're back. I haven't seen much of them. I'm not downtown that much during the day, so I don't know. But keep those reports coming in of stuff you see on Pacific Avenue, 423-4833.
Yeah, they had dossiers. to intimidate the homeless back then, right on the desk in plain view of the front window of the downtown host program office next to the old theater down there when it was down there.
I
used to take note of that, you know, they had files and kind of, you know, lined up, standing straight up and down in a file rack on the main desk, and you could walk by, and they look at you like, yeah, we have your dossier in here. How dare you hang out on the street?
Now they have the park rangers who are walking around the streets. What did you think of the Huff meeting today?
Oh, I liked it, but I need to hang around more and, like, actually get more clear, you know, what the issue is and what's going on. And I need to be, like, updated and caught up on where things have evolved since the mid-90s. Because the mid-90s, I was here from 93 to 96 and got somewhat active in, homeless politics, where basically, I don't even like to use the word homeless, because what I can remember, like,
civil rights for folks outside.
Yeah, is I don't even think that term started becoming a media buzzword till about the mid '80s. Before that, I don't remember people using the word homeless.
It used a little, but it became more fashionable, you know, for charitable purposes, of course.
Right, but homeless seems to indicate that people aren't just temporarily broke. Homeless seems to indicate it's their fault they're poor. I've been explaining to the youth that were born after the mid-1980s when the unions got busted and our jobs got shipped out for cheap labor. They never even seen the prosperity I've seen, like, you know, when we had the 70s and I was in a union and had a trade, which got shipped out overseas, by the way.
They trade.
Boilermakers Union, you know, ship repair. And, like, I used to work up in San Francisco Bay, like at Hunter's Point. Okay. Well, you know, the world's ruling elite decided that they could get cheaper labor elsewhere. And, of course, we all know the story.
Automation. Now.
Yeah. So I've been ensuring the youthful homeless these days, going, hey, it's not your fault. You're poor. You don't even know what happened. If there were jobs, I'm sure most of you would gladly work and get an apartment. But, see, the thing is, I'm going, it's not your fault. Don't let them talk down to you. My parents went through the Great Depression, and they had a lot more respect for poor people than these people ever had, because, you know. Okay.
You should need to reach.
And, like, and it actually should be a hate crime. Poor bashing should be a hate crime. They talk about race. Hey, how about class? How about kicking people while they're down just because actually, secretly, you get a sadistic thrill from it?
I like to kick people when they're down.
Yeah, it makes you feel good and powerful.
I do.
Don't it make you feel good and powerful to kick somebody when you're down? I mean, laugh at the handicap behind her back, laugh at the poor behind
snicker.
Her back.
I don't really laugh. That's impolite. There, David. This will be on the air on tomorrow night.
Yeah.
And, you know, get in touch if you want to talk more. You've got more exciting instances of discrimination or the opposite. They decide to elect you mayor, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. See, because what I do is, it's like when I come back to a town, okay, I'm a stranger, and I know, and I've noticed the distinction between before they perceive me as homeless and after they perceive me as homeless. And it's like suddenly, it seems like suddenly they have the right to treat you like you're just dirt. And it's like an automatic trigger goes off. And they've been programmed this way. They've been brainwashed this way.
Let's not be come on now, Dave. I mean, remember, you homeless people are, I'm not going to give you know, I like to think of you as, I'm not going to tell you.
All right. Well, we're in the land of, we're in Steinbeck country here. Remember Tortilla Flats? Who was the hero in Tortilla Flats? Who was the heroes in Cannery Row? The regular people that were stuck here, the poor working class that were hanging around back then.
I'm sorry, times have changed. And so it goes with this edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides. Likely to return on Sunday at 9:30. You can find old archives on the Huff website at huffsantacruz.org. Look for the name of the show, Bathrob Spears Broadsides. And you'll be able to pour over all kinds of stuff from the past. You can even read over it if you want to look at some of our stuff on the blog, the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom blog, and put you on our email list if you'd like. If you're interested in the Ross Camp situation, give a call to me at 423-4833. I'll put you in touch with folks who can put you to work helping out. Thanks again for listening. Back at you later.
Yeah, yeah, check it out, y'all. When worst come to worst, my peoples come first. My peoples right here, Freak Radio, been holding this down from the beginning. 101.1 FM, Santa Cruz.